Yeah, that's the one I'm practicing. Yeah, this one. My bunny is over the ocean. My bunny is over the sea. My bunny is over the ocean. Oh, bring back my bunny to me.
And because of that, they had to have their kitchens outside because of the threat of fire.
I had to come back down again across the river, down to the river and then walk back the same way. But the thing that struck me about the crevasse was that it is a very hidden place because you have this big area, looks like a kind of snow river or something, and you don't really know how deep it goes or, I mean, I didn't go anywhere near the edge, I'm much too scared. You can walk round it one way, but it seemed too far to go that way, so I walked back towards the farm. And eventually I did come to the end of the crevasse, and I was really pleased that I hadn't tried to cross it, because it was incredibly deep. I was tempted to, I thought, if I just go a little bit further, you know, and just see if I can put my feet in the first little bit of snow. I mean, I was attracted to it because I wanted to know what was underneath the snow, what the landscape was like and what the rocks were like and what was hidden there, how steep it was. And then there's also the element of danger, which is quite a strong magnetic pull towards it. I mean, akin to that feeling where when you're on the edge of a cliff, you think, I could throw myself off.
Sometimes when I was in Queensland, I used to go top a cliff, 10 foot high, 20, 15 high in the air, and I stand over the edge of the cliff, sit on the edge of the cliff and just sit there and meditate. So I just sit there, I close my eyes like this, and I imagine something I'm seeing. That's my spiritual past. then I meditate for 10 minutes and then come back to the earth again, I'm in a spiritual belief. I'm going to peace. I go into a state, and because I used to do my self-defense. I've done karate for nearly 2.5 years. When I used to cross my legs and meditate for an hour one day, and you wouldn't imagine what I was seeing in my head. I'm on a cliff, I see a big wave coming, right? I'll focus on that, and I'll think I'm the wave.
Anne inke reduce ila sun te imani betin che dure. C'est ici que, sur la terre, je m'approche du ciel et regarde la terre.
In many parts of the country, elves live in the rocks and the stones up on the surface. But in this cave, in this particular cave, which is the largest underground space that we know of, so maybe that is the reason, that there is a special type of elves that aren't found anywhere else on the island, and they're called ice elves. And they're called like that simply because they live not in the rocks and the stones, but in the ice formations that get created there every winter with dripping of water and freezing cold floor. These are like ice towers that accumulate there in one area and form what we call Ice Elf City. So they come every winter and stay there. And we are very careful with this space. We don't want to harm this city, this home. And that's what this belief is all about. It's about having respect for the nature. To think twice before you do anything in the nature. To think that you might not only be just, you know, harming something, but someone. The cave is over 1,000 years old, but some hundreds of years after the cave was formed, it started to get this ice. There was no ice being created when it was still warm. So the elves, these ice elves, probably at one point found this cave and decided to stay there, at least for the winters, because that's when the ice gets created. It melts every summer and grows every winter. It's a peaceful place, and especially in the old times. Now we do protect the cave and preserve it, so it doesn't get too much traffic or too many visitors through, or it's not too much bother for the ice elves during the winter. Then in the summer they move. When the palace of the king and queen of the ice elves, when it breaks, that's always the point when they move away for the summer, most likely to the glacier. May, maybe end of May sometimes. But a few formations, they melt first at the bottom, so it's tower of ice. In the case of the palace, as we call it, it's a 2 meter tall tower of ice that first starts to melt at the bottom for some reason, and until it's standing on a needle-thin piece of ice, and then eventually, from one moment to the next, it cracks from its own weight and falls and breaks. And that's the point, even if not all the rest of the formations have melted, that's the point where the whole population of the ice elves moves. Then slowly all the ice just keeps on melting or breaking.
Of the world's people are illiterate, and that there are about 6,000 languages and dialects in the world. And serve him.
The dam. I just love it. I've been there at night, quite dark, and I just feel very comfortable there. Yeah, I'm always here by myself, and I feel safe, you know, and at ease.
Sounds, yeah, lots of wind sounds. Occasionally, two or three times maybe, I heard the sound of the whooper swans above me as they flew over my head. Just about here, the sound of the the river and the rushing, because it's flowing very fast there, and I was just at the top of the cliff.
Yeah, I have places that are special to me, maybe for reasons that no one else has, definitely. Some of them are just because of a very specific type of landscape where the earth kind of is in a specific way where I feel safe there. There are certain places like that I feel protected more than other places because it's a harsh climate and I often feel vulnerable, like the heavy winds, they take my balance and things like that. But then there are other places where I have buried animals, for example, you know, that is a difficult thing. A whole horse, that's very a special thing to do, to put something in the ground like that. And I can always feel that energy from those places. Things like that.
Thank you. We lived in this house that had been built out of the bricks from the old homestead, which was down the track along the river. There was this beautiful long, long driveway lined with olive trees. This must have been a 100-year-old olive tree grove along the driveway. And there's a big monkey puzzle tree, two big stone pines and two Washingtonian palms. There was also a lilac bush, and we didn't really see lilac bushes much, and it would often flower down there. So there was this remnant garden that we'd play and fossick about in as kids. Mum had a lot of chooks, and we'd kill the chooks and they'd hang chickens. Mum would hang them in the apricot tree out the back, because around our house we had some beautiful fruit trees, like a beautiful apricot tree. We'd hang, and there's a particular smell when you pluck the feathers, you dip them in hot water. And something about light. I remember sometimes Mum would clean the windows and she'd take all the curtains off, and it would be this, and you'd have a nap in the afternoon and the light would seem much starker, and somehow there was a feeling of hollowness. The house is a ruin, and then no one ever lived in it again. So sometimes when I've gone back, it's very peculiar, because we go there and the house is deteriorated because of the environment, but my mother's good brown carpet is beautiful wool carpet. It's there, it's still not very worn, but kind of slightly ruined by the animals, and her curtains are still on the windows, but they're all kind of ripped and draped, and the house has shrunk. Yeah, it's really much smaller. It's really about a third of the size smaller.
There's a very small blue flower. Some call them the cat's eyes. It's very, very, very blue and very small. And it has four petals, very small. And you can only see them when the grass is very short. And they blink from the ground. They are so blue. But if you touch them, they close. So it's a really wonderful flower.
But you can't touch it.
I can touch it, but then it closes.
This was a almost completely black landscape, very industrial and sort of remote in its kind of, there wasn't really a human element to it apart from some signposts and a road. The river and the road were, no, actually on this point the river was very blue. but there's sort of the river is running through this black landscape with piles of, it's not gravel, but things that they use for gravel. I liked it because it's all kind of gathered waste material or gathered debris.
We went for a trip once and we were on a main road. They were pointing out this ridge and they said, oh, that's the women dancing, you know, and of course I've never known that.
Yeah, there were just heaps of material which allows you to play in a different way. It's got a weight and a density to it, so it can take you as well as you can take it. So you can physically interact with that.
But for as long as I've been going there, and I've driven up and down that road 1,000 times. Yeah, then they saw another formation. They said, that's the turtle. And you know, like, so there's so much in this landscape, unless you're with people, that, you know, they're going to point out this mythology, you know, and that dancing women went on for quite a long time. And they're dancing because it's quite rhythmic, this piece of rock. So, you know, this landscape is full of these stories that, you know, people know. And then also...
there's a road leading...
it's full of massacres that haven't been declared yet.
A yellow sign.
You know, like, it's such a, you know, it's a really complex...
like triangle-shaped sign with a
red... I don't know what I think about the landscape anymore, you know what I mean?
So the road leads through this landscape up into that... further highlands, and there's a glacier ahead.
And that's the other thing in the landscape, is all these, there's a lot of sacred sites everywhere.
The mountains are black.
And yet, you know, people are climbing the rock. You know, the Aboriginal people have said forever, could you not climb the rock?
The glacier is white.
There's so much money in it that they won't stop it.
The sky is blue. And then down closer,
because everybody wants to climb the stupid rock.
Two or three of these. They're almost like rooftops. Yeah.
And then if you go, I mean, the most gorgeous thing about the rock is to go around it, which is quite maybe 10 km.
Small rocks piled up, but there's no trucks around to take them away.
And that's where some of the really major men's sites are, and you've got to walk away for about a quarter of a kilometre.
Massive amounts of space. And there's no heavy machinery, and there's no tools, and there's no working people.
You can't go near it, you know, which is great.
But it's not much ahead
of me. It shows you how important that site is. That site's really major. Because it's so sacred, you can't go near it.
To the north, rocks. Black rocks.
So they make the tourists walk away, which I think is great.
Further to the west, if I turn around.
And it's a men's site, so if you're a woman, you really have to walk, you know, because, you know, in culture...
there's a river that runs past.
There's men's sites and women's sites, and you can't go onto a men's site.
If you weren't in Iceland, if you were in England and you saw a river this colour blue, it would be a little bit disturbing.
It's so many people have had heart attacks and broken legs, all sorts of stuff going, yeah.
The landscape is completely these little rocks anyway.
Stupid old people going up a rock they can't climb.
It seems...
it's hard, it's really hard.
Unnatural.
When you've got a relationship with Aboriginal people, how...
you shouldn't drink the water or swim in the water.
People just show no respect towards them all the time, you know?
Because so... you never know... what was happening in the environment.
in this landscape you can, there are so many places that you can find and lose again. There are small places. You have to go every day to some place in the lava to really know it. My favorite was going berry picking, blueberry picking. And I could go in the morning and not come back until evening when I was maybe 10. So blueberry picking and having my own places to pick the berries is maybe the most thrill of it. From here we can see one of these places. This was the furthest meadow from our home. And we did go and make the grass here maybe late in August. When we were fetching the hay, I was raking up the rests, and then I did go and lose myself somewhere in there berry picking. And I often slept also. If the weather was good, I lay on the moss and slept. This is a very happy memories. And all the berry picking memories are so good. Still, I don't know anything better than picking berries. Blueberries, yes.
A hidden place means to me when I go up the Black Possum Spur track and I keep going up and I pass Little Mount Arthur Fire Trail and I go up further to the R, and all of a sudden you come to this. So everywhere is gum trees in this section, right? You're walking and walking in gum trees, you know, on this fire track. And then you get up to this top and it's like a secret garden. There's all these, not a lot, but there's some fir trees. And that's like a hidden place to me. It's like you've come to a new place and not many people go there, you know, like this secret garden, you know. So that's something I would describe as a hidden place, you know, something that takes you by surprise. You don't expect, you're not expecting it, and that no one very rarely sees this place.
We had snakes on the farm, of course, because we were on the river. We had lots of brown snakes, and my grandfather made my mother made for my mother a big long metal thing that she could kill them with. So often we'd come home and she would have killed another snake and it would be hanging over a 44-gallon drum that was like the bin. And then one day there was a whole lot of little baby snakes. I thought they came out of the hose, but I think that was wrong. But there was a whole lot of little baby snakes that came up, and somehow Mum caught them all and put them in a bottle of methylated spirits. So we had a bottle, you know how you have your cabinet with all your special crockery from your wedding? Your display cabinet? So in our display cabinet, we had a few things that Mum and Dad got for their wedding, like a nice cake stand, and then there was the bottle with the snakes. But you must never kill a snake. You should just let them go. We had a few special items in that cupboard. One was were the snakes. Another was a bug that went into my father's ear that my mother flushed out that was about this big, about a centimetre long. So Mum was a nurse and knew how to flood it out with some oil. And then there was a Lego block that my sister swallowed. And then there was all the good things in the cupboard.
So to the north, I'm standing with my feet at the edge of the crevasse, and it is going in a horizontal line from left to right in front of me. So for the first 20 metres, I can just see the snow covering the crevasse, and then the snowy hillside beyond that, and then nothing really. There's just mountains in the distance and other kind of snowy peaks, and maybe just a hint of the top of the glacier to the south. I'm facing where the crevasse ends and comes out into the river. So I can see the river in front of me. The crevasse is now on my left, and the river is now going horizontally across. And on the right of the side of my field of vision, I can see a little waterfall. And the cliffs are black, and there's bits of snow in them. And then just in the distance, there's a farmhouse. And then if I turn 90 degrees again and look south, on my left, the river is kind of snaking along until it gets lost in between the hillsides. In this direction, there's lots of snow, and the highlands go on and on and on until there's a peak, just that single peak in the distance. Lots of moorland, lots of sky, and it's windy, and there's lots of moss that's close to me as well. Also, because I had my hood up, now and again it did this very compact little bits of snow, not big, lush, fat snowflakes, but almost like weeny bits of hail, and blown against my hood, so I could hear the sound of the hail hitting my hood as well. And in fact, when that was happening, that was blowing from this direction, I couldn't turn my face to the wind because it was too painful. The sound my feet made, crunching in the snow, and then, because the rocks around here are so distinct and sharp, sometimes when walking on a little mound and you dislodge several of them, they've got a really high-pitched, almost tinny sound as they clatter together and they fall down the little mound. And It reminds me a little bit of the sound that ice makes when it just when you first put it in a gin and tonic, and it does that little clink and starts to melt. The first crack in the ice when it starts to melt, it's a very kind of high pitched little clink, and these rocks are quite high pitched. I liked the sound actually, so I stopped and so that I could hear it.
Svartir sandar, svartir sandar. Hvað nema á skal sett hér á milli sviga merkja. Litlar öldur dansa. Svartir sandar, svartir sandar.
The nicest place in Tassie for me was when I was working down near Port Arthur around a place called Tasman Isle on a fishing boat, and it was 38 foot and it was a flat deck on the back, and we had 15, 18 cray pots. So in the morning we'd go out into the water and we'd put our cray pots in and we'd pick them up. In the evening we'd put the cray pots in, leave them overnight, pick them up again and rebait them. And then in the meantime we're going along the coast and all the rocks have got a very rich green and yellow colour to them, and the water, and it's all so crisp and clear. And the animals, and I was also saying, when you put a cray pot into the water, it's the crispness of the water, it goes this, it's really crack as it goes in. And suddenly when you pull it out, you can see all that rich, beautiful water just pouring off the cray pots, and it's really lovely. And you're in a little fishing boat, bobbing around in the water and looking right up the big cliffs, and you feel alone. And the thing with that particular part of the water, and this is the south coast of Tassie, and so the wind's blowing really, really hard. We only have to come around the corner where Tasman Isle is, and it was really calm. Well, without any engine noise, because it had a Caterpillar turbocharged motor, so that was a crisp noise in itself. But also when because it was on the other side, but you could hear the pot. It's probably about, I don't know, a metre and a bit in diameter, and you throw it in, and it just as it's hitting the water, it sort of gets the little waves, and you hear this. It's a really crisp, because it had a metal base to it as well, so it was just like a real ksh, and you could hear that it was. Everything was very pristine, and I suppose there's no other atmospheric noises, so there wasn't any cars or people or any of these sorts of things. So you could, maybe that's more of it. You could actually hear the noise in its completeness, because it was no other atmospheric sort of noises. So that part of it makes you feel a bit more one with the place, I guess. And then a really lovely, almost like a tortoiseshelly sort of green and yellowy sort of colour all through the place, like all the different vegetation, and the colour of the rocks was a lighter sort of yellow, but obviously very, very old and jagged. And then the bottom underneath, under the water, was all jagged as well, so you can imagine this very jaggedy sort of cliff. And the sound of it is just, waves crashing against the shore. And it's just a very peaceful place. Like you get out there and you just feel completely relaxed. Thank you.